Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Today on The Grave Talks, followed by The Dead, a conversation with Kevin Schmitz. From an incredibly young age, Kevin Schmitz had paranormal experiences, seeing his grandmother glowing in blue late at night in his home, to moving into a haunted house as a teenager. The supernatural has always been a part of his life. After nearly losing his own life in 2005, Kevin discovered that he himself had an even closer connection to the other side than he ever imagined. This is his story today on The Grave Talks.
I think it's going to go back quite a bit for me because I've always been interested in the paranormal. It's not something that I was looking to get into, but, you know, being younger and stuff like that, I always followed like the Warrens, and I used to hit up my local library and take out every book I could on ghosts and stuff like that. But I think the earliest experience for me was probably back in, and I'm going to date myself here, but back in 1977, my grandmother had passed away, and I was very close to my grandmother, and I was very young at the time. And she had been staying with us for a while. She had cancer. And she had told my mom that she felt like she was going to have a stroke. So my mom had taken her to the hospital. So the next day, my mom comes home without my grandma and, you know, pretty much tells me that my grandmother, you know, died and this and that. Now, being as close as I was to my grandmother, I was devastated.
Sure.
So I remember this so vividly. It's like it happened yesterday. I don't know how many days it was afterwards. It could have been the day after. But I had a dream. Well, I thought it was a dream at the time. Doing what I do now, I know it probably wasn't. That my grandmother had come to my room, and she was glowing blue. And she told me, "Don't worry. Don't be upset. I'm okay now." And that's something that's always just kind of stuck with me. And I never really thought much about it until I started doing what I'm doing now. Because in 2005, I had a near-death experience. And after I came out of that, I noticed that I had the ability to, I guess, channel into people's feelings. I guess I'm considered an empath by a lot of people. And it's not something that I embraced willingly. I have a lot of good friends in the paranormal field that are mediums and psychics, such as Chelsea Gill and Christy London. And they tell me all the time, man, you got to be an empath. And just recently, a couple years ago, I ended up back in the hospital, and it was another, I guess, near-death experience for me. And I came out, and I had noticed that I had a really heightened sense of things going on. To go back just a little bit there, when I was in the hospital, I was in the hospital for a year. I was in medical rehab, which is just, you know, fancy talk for nursing home. Mm-hmm. And being in a nursing home and being an empath is not a place you want to be, because anybody that has the empathic ability knows that there's no way to turn that off. So I was getting hit from every direction, and I just chalked it up because what I was in there for was, I had a TBI, traumatic brain injury, and I developed hydrocephaly, and I had to have a shunt put in my head. And the reason I ended up in the hospital the second time was because the shunt failed. And, I went into, I guess, a state of like, I don't want to say dementia, but I really didn't know who I was. And a lot of people thought I wasn't going to recover from that. So when I got out, I had a couple incidences to where I live now where the staff members in the apartment building, I would pick up on things from them. Like they would just walk by me and I'd be like, you know, I'd get something in the back of my head saying, hey, you know, you got a message for them. You need to tell them this or, you know, whatever. So I figured I'd try it out one day. And there was this new kid, Eric, that started. And I, you know, he was made aware of what I could do because I've proved that I could do it on other occasions. And this was a new kid. I didn't know anything about him, but his name, I didn't even know his last name. And I said, I got a message for you. And he's like, well, what is it? I said, well, we'll talk later on. And he called me down later on and we went into to talk and stuff like that. And, you know, I went into some personal details of his life. And this kid, he just turned white. And it was like I was hitting everything right on the head. And, you know, after that, I kind of freaked myself out. And I immediately called Chelsea Gill and I'm like, Chelsea, what's going on? And she's like, just relax, you know, just kind of, you know, she talked me through some stuff. And, you know, I just kind of now I just kind of embrace it. And I use it on, you know, when we investigate once in a while. I've had some experiences. So. It's been a weird ride for me, but like I said, I think it's been something that I've had that I think I just ignored because I went different paths in my life. I mean, I've been a musician for 35 years and then I got into film and, you know, I played hockey and stuff like that. So, you know, it's not something that I put into the forefront.
Sure.
Of my life until recently. So
lots to dissect there. I mean, there are a lot of areas I wanted to dive into. I have a lot of questions I have for you. Let's take it all the way back, though, to the area of childhood, your grandmother and her glowing in blue. I mean, as a child, when you were experiencing that and having that moment, what was going through your mind? I mean, how are you processing that? As a child,
you know, 77 was the year that Star Wars came out. So, you know, the whole blue glowy ghost thing, you know, I just, you know, my grandmother had taken me to see Star Wars when it first premiered here in Western New York. And I just kind of thought at the time that, you know, I'm kind of like correlating the two things, you know, her passing and then, you know, being a huge Jedi nerd and stuff like that. You know, I was just thinking, oh, you know, maybe, you know, this is just my way of coping.
Yeah.
And, you know, being young, I didn't really understand, you know, but through the years, it's always something that's stuck with me. And, you know, it's just something I couldn't shake. And even, you know, as I got older and stuff like that, you know, I would still think about it. And even when I was married and I had kids of my own, my oldest daughter, you know, showed some signs of, you know, having some ability. But, you know, they always say that, you know, kids, you know, they can channel stuff that we can't because, you know, they're not programmed yet to I guess push it aside, you know, because they don't want to seem, you know, crazy or whatever. But yeah, it was a really interesting experience. And going back that far, like I said, I can remember it happening like it was just yesterday. But as far as, you know, how I felt at the time, that's kind of tough because you're talking, you know, almost, you know, over 40 years ago. So
when you had the experience, did you share it with your family or anybody around you?
No, I didn't actually. I shared it with some friends as I became a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you all sit around, you tell spooky stories and stuff like that. And I actually, when I was a teenager, I lived in a house that was haunted. And so it used to come up a lot there.
So that was your first experience, but then you moved into a house that was haunted. So it was by far from your only experience. Tell me about moving into a haunted house and, you know, already having that one experience that you knew was ghostly. But I'm sure you know, you're trying to run it all through your head. You're trying to find explanations. You're trying to, you know, write it off this way, write it off that way to feel normal and fit in and all that. I mean, how did all of that connect then when you moved into this haunted house and then you kind of realized, oh, there's other things that are happening too that I really can't quite explain?
Yeah, the thing with this house is even to this day, I know it's going to sound cliche, but my bedroom in that house always had flies in the window. So, you know, automatically everybody thinks, oh, Amityville type things.
Yeah.
But to this day, I'm going to be 50 years old this year, and I still have nightmares about that bedroom in that house. And what had happened was, I think I was about 13 or 14 years old. And I grew up on the Lower West Side of Buffalo, New York, which is a very historic area. Well, there's been, you know, a lot of history and stuff like that as far as like the War of 1812 and, you know, stuff like that. And where I lived across the street from me, I don't know if you have them in the area that you're in, but, you know, those Mr. Softy ice cream trucks.
Okay.
That go around and they, you know, they sell ice cream or whatever. Well, their factory used to be across the street from my house. And this is relevant to the story.
Okay.
So we're sitting there, me and my buddy was staying over, and I think my mom was out, and I was watching my younger brother, who I think was like 3 at the time. And we lived in an upstairs apartment, and the upstairs apartment and the downstairs apartment were exactly the same as far as the setup. So there was a living room, a dining room, the bathroom, and then right across from the bathroom was my little brother's room, and then the kitchen, and then in the back of the house was my bedroom, and my mom's bedroom was off the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting up there, and we're watching TV, and it's probably like 11 o'clock at night, and out of the corner of my eye, I caught something go from the bathroom into my brother's room. Now, I thought it was my little brother going to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
So I got up and I went and I checked on him, and he was sound asleep. So I went back and I sat down, and then I heard my downstairs neighbor scream. And I was like, oh, well, that, you know, that's kind of weird. You know, I wonder what's going on. So the next day I asked her, I said, you know, was everything okay? We heard you scream last night. And she's like, I don't want to talk about it. And I'm like, well, why not? She's like, oh, because, you know, it was kind of like a weird type experience. And I said, well, you know, last night I thought I seen somebody walk from the bathroom into my brother's room.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, oh my God, her grandson's room was right below my brother's room. And she said she's seen a little girl walk out of her grandson's room into the bathroom. So it was like doing a circle.
Yeah.
Through that. So now that got me peaked. And I've always been kind of like a history nerd. I've always been good with history.
Mm-hmm.
I went and I did some research on that particular area. And this is where the Mr. Softy factory comes into play.
Okay.
Back in the 30s, 40-ish era, when the factory was still there and active, a little girl was hit by an ice cream truck out front of my house and killed.
Okay.
So that kind of put two and two together for me.
Yeah.
As far as that experience. But it went on to be more in that place than just that. I was really big into CB radios when I was younger. And I was terrified of my attic in that apartment house. And I would go up to the attic to mount my CB antenna.
Yeah.
And I always felt like something was watching me. So I would just hurry up and just run downstairs back to my house. And, you know, I was petrified of going up in the attic. And like I said, to this day, I still have nightmares about that, you know, like my room with the flies in the window, you know, like hearing voices in there. Although I don't remember ever hearing anything, but I remember the fear that I felt being up in that attic and feeling like something was watching me. And I truly feel like there was something there.
Yeah.
Even now, if I go past that house, it just freaks me out a little bit, because it's like, I wonder if the people that are living there now are having any experiences. And sometimes I want to stop and ask, but I never do.
What's your take on this? I mean, the idea that, you know, there was an innocent girl who was hit by the ice cream truck and killed, but then this fear, this feeling that you had in that house. I mean, that's not necessarily something that you would think, you know, a little girl, if she's haunting it, would, you know, be out to instill in anybody. You know, I can't imagine she's suddenly turned evil or something like that. Is it more so just the kind of the processing of it as a human of, oh my God, there's something paranormal going on, that you kind of take it to that dark place? Or do you think that it really was the little girl that was there? Or was it something else that was there that made you feel that fear, is what I'm trying to say?
Honestly, if I had the answer to that, I guess I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. But I do feel that there was probably something more there, because like I said, that being a historic area, you know, when I lived there, you know, it was relatively safe. But back in the 30s and the 20s, during Prohibition, in that area being so close to Canada, there was a lot of mob activity that went on, especially in the neighborhood I lived in was all Italian and German.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of mob ties in that area. So I don't know, maybe something had happened on that the house or the property. I mean, I know the house was built in the early 1900s. But that's, you know, as far as the history of the house, that's all I really, really know about that. So yeah, as far as that goes, I mean, it's just one of those things that, you know, again, it was something that piqued my interest. Like I said, being a history nerd, I wanted to know as much as I can. So I went and got a bunch of books, and, you know, the main thing for me was the Warrens. Their book, The Demonologist,
sure,
to this day still scares the living bejesus out of me.
Mm-hmm.
Just to know that they experienced that stuff and that it was true. And, you know, the franchise movies that are out now,
yeah,
you know, are all based on them stories. And, you know, I remember reading those stories and being like, oh, come on. You know, it's like, this is a little too good to be true. But but like I said, I've had experiences now doing what I'm doing, and, you know, especially working with Dan Klass and being part of the Hinsdale House. I'll tell you, it's been a wild ride the past couple of years.
I bet. And we'll get to that in a little bit, because I do want to talk about the Hinsdale House. We've talked about it on the program several times in the past with Dan himself and others. But let's talk more about your experiences. So you had these experiences prior to going through a near-death experience in 2005. So it wasn't as if that 2005 experience suddenly opened you up to the paranormal. You already kind of had this, it was there. I mean, I'm not going to speak for you and say you were sensitive prior to that, but I mean, you tell me. I mean, what was the thing that really kind of made you feel like you were opened up more after that 2005 experience when you compare it to the rest of your life, where you already, you know, you had had some experiences there. Did it somehow open that veil even more for you?
I think it really did. You know, like I said, at the time I had I split from my wife and I had moved to DC, mm-hmm. where all this happened. And, you know, after I got out of the hospital, I was staying with my best friend and his girlfriend. And we lived like a half a mile from the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very historic area I lived in. And I would notice that I would be getting feelings when we were driving around. Now, I just had brain surgery, so I'm thinking, you know, okay, maybe this is just,
sure,
you know, something, you know, you're
looking for the looking for the logical, essentially, of what,
right, yeah, right. And, you know, I would hear things, but I guess I would feel things, and they would seem real to me. Mm-hmm. And I know nobody else was experiencing the same things that I was. So I didn't really want to say anything because, like I said, I had just had this major surgery. I apologize for that. I just had this major surgery, and I didn't want people to think that this is, you know, part of the recovery from the surgery, or maybe I'm just totally messed up from what happened.
Sure.
So as time went on, I started to notice that I had the ability to read people. And when I say read people, I don't mean like, you know, size them up. I mean, like, I can sense things about them. I can sense if they're upset. I can sense if they're happy, you know, or if something terrible is going on in their lives. Mm-hmm. But again, it's just something that I kind of tucked back because I didn't want to be the, you know, the weird friend, you know. So I kind of tucked it back and just kind of went on with my life. And you know, after everything happened, I had to give up a few things that, you know, were very important to me growing up, like hockey. And I was afraid that I was going to lose my ability to be a musician, but luckily I didn't. Mm-hmm. So I kind of just went on with things, and then was offered an opportunity to get into film, which is something I didn't want to do. I had no inspiration to do it, and it was kind of forced into it and fell in love with it. And that's what kind of led me to where I'm at now. So that's why I brought that up, to kind of make a bridge there.
Sure.
From then to there, or from there to here.
I mean, what was that like, though? I mean, when you are feeling these things, you're sensing these things that, you know, others are not sensing, and you also are very aware you just had brain surgery. I mean, there has to be a level where you're second guessing yourself, going, is this my new normal? Am I always going to kind of feel this way, where I feel kind of off and I'm seeing and hearing things that others are not? But it's not paranormal. It's just my mind firing in ways that are not, you know, what they would have been. I mean, how do you bridge that gap to eventually say, this is not a repercussion of the surgery, this is actually happening?
Well, the thing is after, you know, splitting with my wife and then, you know, moving to another city, leaving my kids, and basically rebuilding my life after being with somebody for 13 years.
Yeah.
You know, I went through a bad depression. I was, you know, I was really depressed. And then, you know, within 5 months after that, I'm in the hospital fighting for my life. And,
sure,
you know, they basically told my best friend who I was staying with that I probably only had like 6 months to live, and that he needed to call my family.
Yeah.
They told him I had a tumor on my brain stem and it was inoperable, and, you know, this and that. So
very,
you know,
dire.
Going through all that and then coming out of it, you know, and trying to go back, because I had a really good job when I moved to DC, and trying to get back into that and not being able to do that anymore because I couldn't keep my focus on anything. And then, you know, being depressed and trying to seek help for that. And then having these feelings, you know, that I can sense things. Honestly, to be 100% honest with you, I thought I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
I thought I was going down a spiral that there wasn't going to be any coming back from.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, that wasn't the case. You know, I was able to get better and then move back to Western New York here, and got in, like I said, got into some stuff that led to me meeting up with Dan and getting into the paranormal and stuff like that, and then realizing that, okay, there was a reason all this happened.
Sure.
You know, it all makes sense to me now.
I mean, how did you do that? How did you take your life from that? And this isn't not necessarily a paranormal question or anything like that. It's more of an inspiration type question of you were it's such dire straits where doctors are saying this isn't going to work. I mean, how did you come out of that, you know, and be able to talk with us today as you are?
Well, the thing is, you know, I had mentioned my grandmother dying of cancer. Cancer, unfortunately, runs in the women of my family. I lost my great-grandmother, my grandmother, my mother, and my aunt, all the different forms of cancer. And I think there is some kind of acceptance when you're dealing with that kind of loss. There's an acceptance that you build inside yourself to accept things that you know you can't change.
Mm-hmm.
And when all this happened to me, I guess I came to a point where I was like, look, you know, if this is the end, this is the end. There's nothing I'm going to do to stop it. I can pray. I can, you know, do all this stuff. But if it's my time, it's my time. And there is no way I could stop it. And I think having that mentality allowed me to persevere and deal with things a little better than I was dealing with them.
At the end, then, do you end up with an even greater sense of life and gratefulness for life and grace of, you know, just yourself and life and others when you are able to come out of that feeling like this is the end and really believing it is? But then somehow the tables turn enough to go, maybe it's not. I mean, that's got to be a turning point for you where it's like, oh, my gosh. I mean, how, you know, suddenly you get like this second lease on life that you thought was never going to happen. I mean, that in itself is an amazing experience. Does that then translate into a greater sensitivity as well because of that awareness?
I think that it does, because I always tell people, if you knew me before that happened to me, you probably wouldn't like me.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that I was a bad person,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I've been a musician since I was 14 years old, and yeah. I was playing in bars in the 80s and stuff like that. And I was a drummer. So, you know, what they say about drummers. So, you know, I was kind of, you know, I was a douchebag, if you put it like that. I'll just put that right out there. You know, it was the 80s, you know, I used a lot of women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I also had a really bad drinking problem back then,
mm-hmm.
you know, playing in bars at 14 and, you know, having people slipping you shots.
Sure.
And, you know, stuff like that, you know, you start to develop a habit.
Good luck getting out of that without having one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I always tell people that the end of the 80s into the early 90s is a blur for me,
mm-hmm.
because of everything that was going on in my life and mm-hmm. my lifestyle. Fortunately, I never did drugs. I lost a lot of good friends back then to, you know, heroin and, you know, harder drugs like that. I mean, I smoke pot. I mean, who hasn't really?
Sure.
But as far as like the harder stuff, I'm terrified of needles. So that was always the ongoing joke with my mom. You never have to worry about me doing hardcore drugs because I'm terrified of needles.
Yeah.
I always tell people, and they don't believe that that's the kind of person that I was. Mm-hmm. But after what happened to me, it gave me a different outlook on life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, well, I'm here for a reason. If I wasn't here for a reason, it would have been over. I mean, and everybody says, well, you're probably here for your kids. Well, you know, my kids are in their mid-20s now, and, you know, they don't really need me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still here.
Sure.
So there's got to be a greater purpose for me. And, you know, all this happened to me in 2005 when I was 35 years old. So imagine being 35 years old and being faced with your own mortality.
Sure.
So everybody has their bucket list. Well, I started living my bucket list. You know, I always wanted to, storm chase. So I became a storm chaser. You know, I went around chasing tornadoes and stuff like that, kind of living on the edge. And everybody was calling me an adrenaline junkie and stuff like that. And it had nothing to do with it. It was just, you know, there's things I still want to do. And there's still things now that I want to do.
Sure.
But, you know, I learned how to scuba dive. So, you know, I did some scuba diving for a while, and just kind of getting things out of the way so that if something did happen to me, I wasn't one of those people that are stuck here because you didn't accomplish what you wanted to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a very exciting life up until this point, and it's still getting exciting. I mean, doing what I'm doing now and getting to see the things that I see, and I mean, it's just crazy. I never thought in a million years I'd be doing what I'm doing. And, I'm very grateful for that. And I'm very grateful for being able to do that, because a lot of people don't recover from what I went through.
Sure.
Twice.
Yeah, exactly. That's going to wrap up part one of our conversation. In part two, what led Kevin to dive deeper into the paranormal after nearly losing his life? How did a zombie movie lead to Kevin being involved with the paranormal on a deeper level? What went through Kevin's mind as a scratch slowly formed in real time on his back and on camera? Does Kevin feel that the dead can communicate with him easier because of his near-death experiences? And what kind of dark spirits lurk within the Hinsdale House? Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.